I'd like to introduce Anna Mercedes from Minnesota again. We had a great discussion on Monday on race and theology, and today it's going to be queer theology, which yes. I'm very excited to learn more about. So awesome. We'll leave the door open. If more come in, that's great. So.
Excellent. Good. Well, see, now someone's coming yes. in right away. She said, if yes, more come great. In, that's great. And then in you can.
Yes.
Come on in. So I am Anna, as Sharon was saying, and I've come to you from central Minnesota, where I teach at two Benedictine Catholic schools there, and I grew up on the East Coast in the North Carolina Synod of the ELCA. It was my second time at Olden. So, Queer Theology 101, that's our topic for today, and I'd like to start by getting a sense of what your hopes are for coming to such a session, and that will give me a little bit of a sense of how much you've thought about these topics, queer theology topics, or how much you've already been in the sources and how much you already know about this. And then I will shape our session accordingly. Well, thank you. Okay, so I love to talk about this topic. I think queer theology is an area where we have great space for creativity in the churches, and so it's one of my favorite types of theology to do, to be part of. What I'm going to try to do here is lead you into that and help you figure out how you could do a little queer theology yourself if you'd like to. This could be something you do over the course of an afternoon when you go hiking, or it could be a kind of practice you adopt theologically as a way of thinking in your life. So I offer it to you as a method for thinking theologically. So first, we should do a little bit with just the terms, because I see that will be helpful. So you can also study, read about LGBT liberation theology. Mm-hmm. That's also a thing you'll come across and read. And what I'm talking about here today encompasses that. When something like queer theology was just getting going, and when this may have been more frequently called gay liberation theology, often the function of it was to try to bring inclusion for lesbian and gay persons into the church. It was a theological assertion of voice, a way to say this is a conversation that needs to be happening in the church. We need to be talking about our human sexual diversity, and we need to find space within the church to have diverse sexualities. So in that sense, the theology would very much have been trying to open the door in the churches to particular persons, mm-hmm. or to deconstruct policies in churches that made churches so exclusive. Queer theology, though, has in some sense always been, and certainly is now also, a wider thing, and that is a corrective over theology all the way through. So instead of just, okay, we've got theology, and then we also need to find a way to welcome lesbian and gay persons, as though theology over here wasn't about lesbian and gay persons, queer theology would say heteronormativity has its hold on Christian theology as a whole in modern times, and queer theology. You can come on in if you wish.
Oh no, I was just going to shut the door. Nobody was in here.
Oh, well, he's the fire marshal.
Since we're here, we have it open.
Because we can let it stay open.
Well, thanks.
Enjoy.
Thank you. So rather than just saying, here's some kind of other theology, and then we better do a little gay and lesbian liberation theology to try to make things inclusive for people, queer theology would say, no, there isn't some theology that hasn't been heteronormalized in modernity. Modernity being so thoroughgoingly heteronormative, at least in the West. I'm not going to try to speak for every cultural frame right now. So queer theology would be about trying to imagine what theology can be when that heteronormative frame is disentangled, dissolved. What is theology then? And so in this sense, queer theology is a thing for anyone. It's not simply about certain populations amongst all our wide ways of loving as humans. It would be for everyone. Because it would say heteronormativity has affected the theology of everyone in modernity. So queer theology then becomes a big thing. And the word queer itself isn't inherently any kind of theological word. This, of course, is coming already from gay liberation movements, so, and then being used in theology. And as you probably all already knew on your own, queer was at first a derogatory term that was then claimed with pride as a strong word for loving and living outside of heteronormativity. So queer is a good word to use. You can also, of course, say LGBTQ theology. But my struggle with saying that is it can sound to you like I'm trying to say, how do persons from a lesbian perspective do theology? Which we could also explore. But queer theology would be more like, how has hegemonic heteronormativity, overarching, controlling heteronormativity affected theology all the way down, so that no matter whether you're identifying as lesbian or bi or straight, theology in the air has had these heteronorms. So it can contaminate everybody's theology then. So this is why I'm using Queer Theology 101 instead of LGBT Theology 101 for this session. So my main premise right away would be queer theology is for everyone. It's about deconstructing heteronormativity. And so then I should say, what's heteronormativity? I keep throwing that out, and some of you are like, yeah, sure, right. And I can tell a few of you are very comfortable with the word. So you know the word normativity, something that's made to be normal. So heteronormativity would just be that which makes heterosexuality and hetero relationships normal. And this is pretty big and deep, such that it's hegemonic, the other big word I used a minute ago. That is, that it's in the air, it's in the water, that it's a major functional way of organizing life, thinking about what's good and right. Heteronormativity has that power. And so it rivals some big other oppressive powers in Western modernity. And finally now, this is all by way of introduction, I keep also using the word modernity, and this is to signal to you that heterosexuality is a modern thing. Those of you who were here for talking about race and Theology 101 on Monday night heard me saying that race is a modern thing. So is heterosexuality. That is very confusing for some of my students when I work with them on that back home. So if I'm going too fast on this, you should feel free. We're only 7 people in this room to slow me down and ask questions. So we don't have a term for heterosexuality until the late 1800s. The late 1800s. And we also don't have a term for homosexuality until the late 1800s. I think it's the 1860s or the 1880s. I'm fuzzy on my exact number right this minute. The other fun fact, if you really want to confuse folks after you leave this session, is that homosexuality comes first. So, and what I mean here is the term comes into discourse first. But it's a fun thing to throw out at the dinner table. Ask people what comes first, homosexuality or heterosexuality. Because of the power of heteronormativity, almost everyone is going to think, well, heterosexuality came first, of course. But the fun point here is that the term homosexuality emerges into English as a concept, as a way of thinking about human sexual desire and human sexual relationship, a number of years before heterosexuality is given a name as a concept. And so heterosexuality needs to come along as a word, as some sort of juxtaposition to this inherently non-normal term. And by inherently non-normal, I mean homosexuality was coined as a label for a non-normal. They were the folks trying to name it were naming something that they thought was not the normal. They didn't have a name for the normal yet. So at its root, this term homosexuality, not the practice of it or the living of it, but the term was a term for something non-normal. And in that sense, the term doesn't have a whole lot of life to it. And that's part of why saying something like queer or gay or lesbian has some more potential, because it doesn't stem from that at-root labeling of an abnormal. So then heterosexuality, then there needs to be some way of saying what this other way of doing human sexual desire is, and then we get the term heterosexuality from that. So then you can ask yourself, well, what in the world, what did we have before then? Clearly we had people, and we had people, we had sexuality, and we had people in sexual pairing, and we had all sorts of things. But surely this is older than either the 1860s or the 1880s, whichever it turns out. And you're right, of course, we've always had bodies. As long as we can talk about humans, we've had bodies and we've had loves. The point for an exercise of thinking about queer theology would be to say, we didn't label those loves, those desires, those ways of doing family in these ways. These ways of labeling them are very, very modern. So there are people who have tried to trace what used to go on. And that conversation is always necessarily a certain cultural conversation. So these terms, heterosexuality and homosexuality, these are Western terms. And so I'm most familiar with people who have read back before those terms and tried to see what was going on in the West, in the development of Western culture before we get to those terms. But it would be a whole different exercise, and one I'm not equipped to lead you through right now, to look at other cultures and other times outside of the development of Western culture. So I'm just trying to help you see that we're in this very narrow pocket of human loving and being. It's relevant to Christianity, since Christianity does develop so largely along these Western lines, although of course we have other patterns of Christianity too. So to the extent that Christianity and the West have coalesced so powerfully in modernity, it's important to look at what's been going on in the West. So if you look back, for instance, at the biblical time period, so one of you is asking about the Bible, what you see there is a radically different kind of sexuality. And you actually see, I'm talking about the New Testament here, not even the Hebrew Bible, because it switches. It's not even a time period where we speculate that you could walk up and say to somebody something like, well, tell me about your sexuality. We could maybe do that now because we almost use sexuality like it's a part of your personality. Like, tell me about your spirituality. And maybe once I get to know you well, what about your sexuality? Or, you know, what sort of environmental ethics do you follow? And what about your politics? Like, these are parts of us, somehow. Like, your sexuality is a thing. Like, you would expect, I have young daughters, like, you would expect that they have one. Like, sexuality is a thing, and we each have one. That's a weird and modern thing to think, that we could have sexualities, that sexualities will turn on in my daughters at some time, that people just have them in their cells, hidden beneath their belly button somewhere. That's not the way sexuality, well, see, I can barely talk without using the term. That's not the way the sort of affective, loving practices that tend toward mating and reproduction and all this, that's not the way they've always been categorized. So when you look at the New Testament period, it doesn't seem like they have that kind of thing. Like, you could have gotten to the root of anybody's sexuality in that time period, which is why trying to get after, like Jesus' sexuality or something is a really odd pairing of modern problems with an older time period. Rather, they tend to, at least in Roman culture that's so influencing a lot of the New Testament context, it seems like genital sexuality, especially male genital, so I shouldn't say the word sexuality. Let's see if I can do this without. Let me try. Male genital arousal seems to be an expression of political power. It does not seem to be tied to romance and certainly not to pairings, the way current heterosexuality and homosexuality seems to be. Think how much in your mind, I'm just speculating about your minds, that heterosexuality and homosexuality today tend to be about who someone is drawn to, who someone will partner with, as though we all sort of knock down into these little dyads. I'm trying to show you that New Testament context, that's not a way to think about sexuality or even households back then. There weren't these little, like, dyads with kids, right? That's not, the culture was done so differently. So to give you an example here of the political power piece, it seems to in the New Testament time period, be largely connected to male genitalia. Women seem to be so off the radar politically. It was relevant perhaps for this group of seven of us sitting here all on the day before International Women's Day. So women in that time period were seen as something like unmen. This is a category that gets used in some of the scholarship. There weren't men and women in Roman culture or Roman way of thinking. Rather, there were men that turned out right and men that were kind of messed up and soft. And those that were messed up and soft and kind of drippy and fluctuating, those were what we think of as women. So this time period, some scholars call it a time of a one-sex system. Like there's people, and there's people who came out real well, and those are hard and firm. And so the erect phallus becomes like this symbol of that, of the good person. And then there's soft, messy people. And some people with a phallus are those soft, messy people. So like men who didn't have citizenship status were seen as not real men. And in fact, there were more terms for man than just one. And only one of those terms was really the real man term. And if you're just kind of curious about this, it was vir, V-I-R, which is the root for the word virtue. So I always kind of laugh when people talk about women having virtues, because it just, like, at the root, it doesn't work. You're really saying the manliness of a woman. It's just an application of something from an old time. So at any rate, in the New Testament time period, when you are reading about things that look like sexual norms in the Bible, you are truly reading about a very different context than anything like how we relate and how we think about genital pleasure, how we think about love and affection, how we think about families. It's so different. This doesn't mean that the Bible doesn't give us any kind of guidance. It does mean that we can't do any kind of one-to-one transfer. We can't say, here's the message about how people should marry, for instance, and say that relates to now. It was a very different message in its time. So in other words, there's a whole lot more translation to do than just translation out of the Greek. You also have to translate out of the culture to try to get it over to what it can mean for today. So after you have said to someone at your dinner table what came first, homosexuality or heterosexuality, and surprised them with homosexuality, you can also say, what does the Bible say about homosexuality? And when they try to answer you, you can finally just say it says nothing about homosexuality. It can't. There is no concept of homosexuality in the Bible. And then you can really confuse your table and say there's no heterosexuality in the Bible. And then someone may say, well, what do you mean? I mean, men and women, you see men and women partnering. You say, sure, but do you see the kind of innate orientation that leads to some sort of a necessary pairing with what we think of as an opposite sex? Remember, there's no opposite. I was just telling you it's a one-sex system, but now we have this opposite idea. Do you see the sort of pairing that's fundamental in a person and then can lead toward a kind of lifelong connection? That's what I would say to your dinner table friends. No, like, that's not what we see here. We see very different norms in the Bible. And I've just been talking to you about the New Testament context here. If we switch then later and try to go into the Hebrew Bible and look at the way women and men and something like what we now call sexuality show up there, it's a whole other conversation. So I would say anybody who wants to delve into these things should feel excited to do so. It's not like it's off limits because it's so hard to translate. It's just that the people should know that it's a whole nother culture. It's a whole nother set of cultures that you're diving into when you go into the Bible. And so anyone who has been hurt by a kind of one-to-one application where someone has said, this Bible verse says you are wrong, they can know, that person who has been hurt in that way, can know that whoever was doing that was really misappropriating the biblical text, because it really requires cultural unraveling in order to get at some of the things that we see there. Okay, so that was your little lesson part to try to get us on the same platform with the terms queer, heteronormative, and the ideas that heterosexuality and homosexuality are new terms. If you think of how long Christian history has been, to imagine that we haven't even had these terms for more than 150 years is just really weird. That's really new terms. All right, so my suggestion is that any of us can figure out how we might like to do a little queer theology by trying to take apart the ways heteronormativity has shaped any of our brains. I know it has shaped mine, and I can't guess at yours, but I know it's had effect over some of the students I work with, for instance, so I know it's pretty common. And the first time that it occurred to me that this could be done, I was talking to my home church. They were having a 100th anniversary. It was their centennial. And they invited anybody who had gone to seminary to come back and to speak to them. And I decided to do a presentation on 100 years in theology and try to help them see what had changed through time. And I got to the part where I was talking about gay and lesbian liberation theology, and much like the church you mentioned, our church was trying to be a kind of reconciling church. They had never actually managed to become a reconciling church, but there had been some movement to get in that direction. So I still remember which woman it was raised her hand, and she was really a mover and a shaker in the congregation and somebody who was always willing to kind of ask the hard questions. And she said something like, so we really need to think about this stuff in order to become more welcoming, right? And I think until I gave that presentation, I would have said, yeah, right. Like, if Christians care about each other, we should care about all the hate crimes against gay and lesbian persons, and we who are gay and lesbian should speak up for those who are gay and lesbian and don't find a place in the churches. I think that's how I would have answered. But that day when I looked at her, I said, well, it's not just that. I mean, yes, Christians need to be more welcoming, but Christianity as a whole is missing out on a whole vision of what love can look like by excluding this entire set of ways of loving. So it's really not just about opening the door wider, it's also about getting in on the revelation of love ourselves. And so from that day on, I thought, this is more than just about like being good Christians or being welcoming. This is about chasing after who God can be and how we can love in the world. So what I'd like you to try to do is help me get a sense of what heteronormativity does to our brains. Now, this is a bit of an improvisational exercise. I don't know if you're up for it this afternoon, but we're going to find out. Okay, so in order to do that, we need to kind of get out there on this flip chart in front of us some of the stereotypes that go with these two components of heteronormativity, masculinity and femininity. Because as you know, heteronormativity involves a kind of complementarity of those two things. Okay, so first, we're going to get some masculine and feminine stereotypes up here, and then we're going to try to get the stereotypes that might go with a heteronormalizing of those. But let's just first start with the stereotypes themselves. This doesn't have to take us very long because I'm sure you have thought about this before. So I'm going to just write the word man and the word woman here. And what I would like you to do is try to give me some words that go with the sort of stereotypical man, the stereotypically perfect man. Anything you can think of.
Strong.
Yeah, that's the first one that comes to my mind too. Just anything else. You've already done this in your life, I'm pretty sure.
Provider,
okay, yeah.
Authority.
Yes, authority. None of my markers are very satisfying.
I know, we need to get you some better markers.
Oh, look at this one. Okay, we got this one.
Authority, provider, strong. What else? Or you can give me some woman ones.
Emotional.
Okay.
Nurturing.
Yeah.
I was just like listening to this podcast, and they were basically breaking it up to like submissive for women submissive. And aggressive for men.
Yeah. Yes, I think that's a really great way to just kind of summarize it. Yeah. Okay. So we could also put soft for woman, or sometimes passive can go with submissive, and active can go here with aggressive.
Pursues or pursuing and
yes.
Pursued.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Any other thoughts there? I'm just really assuming that this is not actually a new exercise in any of your minds. But what might be new is trying to take this to a place of queer theology here in a minute. So now we're going to go to what happens when you turn this into heteronormativity. Okay, so for man, we've reminded ourselves of these stereotypes: strong, provider, authority, aggressive, acting, pursuing. And for woman, we've reminded ourselves soft, emotional, nurturing, submissive, passive, and pursued. Okay, so how does heteronormativity combine these? Let's make it a less scary word for ourselves, because heteronormativity just sounds a little overwhelming right this moment. So let's just say heterosexuality equals, if heterosexuality is this paired with this, what does it equal? If your mind comes up with an answer, tell me and I will write it down. Did anyone get something?
Patriarchal.
Yep, that's good. Okay. Patriarchal. And my mind thought one over the other.
Yeah.
In other words, I don't, and this is kind of also patriarchal, I don't see here mutuality. These are not like two equals side by side. This is something else. What else is it?
Maybe complementarian, but that sort of goes...
Yeah.
Not with non-equal.
Yeah. Well, let's just write it out that way. Non-equal complementarity.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you're trying to balance it, but it's like balancing strong with weakness. So it's like
yeah.
A need on one side.
There's what on one side?
A need on one side.
Yes. I'm writing an unbalanced attempt at balance. So it feels appropriate for me to stop for a minute and say, of course, we all recognize that there are men and women who love one another who have attempted to love one another in some way that's dynamically different from this. I grant that. If you didn't think I was granting that, let me acknowledge it. Rather, what I'm trying to probe here is, what is this system of thought, this kind of cultural category, push us toward? And I think it pushes people toward it to such a degree that any one given man and woman trying to live outside of this actually has to work against it to do what they're trying to do. Okay, so let's see if there's just anything else.
I don't know what the term would be, but it's like really limits people to certain roles.
Yes.
Like there's a male role and a female role, and you live within that.
Confines life to roles.
Yeah.
Good. This I yes, you got something.
I was just thinking it's really like set up for opposites to exist,
yes.
Like cohabitate.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Whew. All right. So, I'll just review this real quick. So we have man as strong provider, authority, aggressive, active, pursuing; woman as soft, emotional, nurturing, submissive, passive, and pursued. Combining those two together into heterosexuality, we get a system which is patriarchal. There's need on one side. It's a non-equal complementarity. It confines life to roles. It's based on opposites. One is over another, and there's an unbalanced attempt at balance. If I take that heterosexuality and move it up to heteronormativity, such that this whole system that we've written on our paper is normalized, then we get to a place in which any deviation from this is punished in some way. You know, because norms are put into being as norms, and so there's some sort of cultural policing of that. So it stops being just a thing, heterosexuality, and becomes a norm when it is legalized, when it is socially rewarded economically and with political power, when anyone setting aside these ways is either gently or aggressively or violently punished for stepping outside these bounds. And so heteronormativity takes this system you've sketched out and makes it pretty dangerous and makes it enforced with violence. If violence enters into the picture, given the stereotypes that you put out already, it's not hard for you to see that a lot of that violence is in a heteronormalized system, defined as appropriate as long as it's coming on this man side, because the man side is already this aggressive side. So now what I'd like you to do is, and this is where we start doing the theology part of things. What I'd like you to do is think about how that system of heterosexuality, or I would suggest heteronormativity, reveals for us what a heteronormative theology would look like. Okay, so in order to do that, then, I want you to focus on these terms down here at the bottom. I'm not sure. I'm going to build a pile of Bibles so that you can see. Okay. How's that? Okay. All right. So if we live in a society or culture that has taught us these things about heterosexuality, and then our theology reinforces reinforces this, what do we pick up as a heteronormative theology? Another way of saying that is, what does all this teach us about God? So it doesn't have to necessarily be something you believe or want to believe, just kind of as a thought experiment, try to answer the question, heteronormative theology equals. And if you think of something, tell me and I'll write it down.
God is male.
Okay, there's a good place to start. Okay,
that's
God.
Pretty
it's the elephant in the room. Yeah. God as male. What else?
Those who are not God need to fit the weaker side of things.
That's
female
great.
Female side.
Yes.
Well, it really explains the whole authority.
It does.
Complex. Sorry.
Yeah, that's well said. Okay. And when you thought, when you said it explains the whole authority context, do you mean of the church, of God, of male clergy? What did you mean there?
Of the patriarchy.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
Sorry.
Well, I figured there were multiple ways to get at that. Okay, explains the authority complex of the patriarchy. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I really love how Lisa put this. Those who are not God, you know, in other words, everybody else needs to be weak, which I think is so telling right there. That's for me a major issue in this heteronormative theology. If everybody other than God, everybody not in the God position, needs to be in this weak and passive position. For me, that already starts sending up some red flags for Christian theology, because when I read the scriptural story, when I hear the liturgy, I don't hear a disempowered message. So this heteronormative thing doesn't work all that well, I would say. And I guess I should give Lisa's phrase more credit, because those who are not God, actually, I wrote it down just that way, because your way of putting it is better than just saying everyone else. Because there are, of course, the God symbolizers in the system. So like priests or religious authorities actually kind of get to be the on the strong side or the male side.
Well, even in a real patriarchal household, the male represents
God,
the will,
the
authority
of
God. Of God.
Yeah. Right.
Not ever God, because that would be sacrilegious.
But the power of God, the authority.
Father knows best.
So heteronormative, that's great. Heteronormative theology equals Father knows best.
Yeah.
Good.
I think of female sexuality is sinful.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Right. Female sexuality as sinful and
tempting or devil.
Yeah.
Temptation instead of
associated with the devil, not God. I told you earlier just a brief sketch that the New Testament has such a very different idea, and I was. Of our bodies and what we think of as sexual pleasure. And I glossed right over it, but one of the things that's really interesting for me there is that female sexual pleasure is just not on the scene of the New Testament biblical writers barely at all, which on one hand isn't surprising if you think about cultural context. But I do think that leads to some interesting thinking for women today. And one of the things that the Romans 1 text does, Romans 1 is one of the places where something like what we think about as homosexuality seems to be talked about, but it really isn't talking about homosexuality. That's the one place where you see the Bible saying that women loving women is against nature. What we could look at if we went way down there, and the place any of you should look if you want to go look, is in this book called God's Beauty Parlor by Stephen Moore, who was one of my professors, and he looks at the way against nature in that context meant an inferior, a social inferior, having the gall to be a penetrator. Because as I was telling you earlier, these male genitalia was so culturally symbolic. Did I mention the lampposts earlier? Did I ever mention the lampposts? I don't think I did. Archaeology has actually dug up these lampposts that were an erect phallus on the lamps. It was that normal. It was a sign of power, right? So the idea that a woman could penetrate another woman was so unimaginable to that cultural context that was really seen as against nature. So that tells you nature had nothing to do with how we think of like biology, cells, inner drives. No, it was nature meant social system. It was against custom. But so when Romans 1 says for a woman to love another woman is against nature, what it's meaning is, well, she can't be on top. That's really what it's saying there. She can't be the penetrator. It was like an unimaginable idea. But so to then take that Romans 1 and try to throw it at gay and lesbian life today is just so absurd, really, because it's really talking about an upsetting of a social system that many people already would find worthy of being upset, you know? So in other words, in that social system, It was so radically hierarchical that our hierarchies look pretty soft now in exchange. So if somebody is saying that Romans 1 needs to prevail, then they're really saying that, you know, all women are always not just sexual but social bottoms. And that all slaves are social and sexual bottoms. It's really very problematic. Anyway, that was a deviation, but that all goes together with this idea of female sexuality as just sinful or bad, almost unimaginable. It's really off the map of the heteronormative theology, which is making sense of how you get to the father knows best, male initiates relationships, also male initiates sexual pleasure, all of that. It all ends up revolving around the male in this heteronormative theology. So what else? I can't see what we've got down there. What else do we have for heterosexuality? Is it, we've already done patriarchy, right? What else is on there?
Unbalanced, unequal.
Okay, unbalanced. So a heteronormative theology, in what ways is a heteronormative theology unbalanced? What lack of balance do you know of in theology?
Women represented in the Bible.
Right, okay. Women are less represented, and then let yourselves turn off gender categories all told. Just what is unbalanced in theology itself? You don't have to think in terms of gender. See that you're really cogitating on this one. I'll just suggest to you that power is rather centralized in a lot of theology, and I think that's one of the characteristics of a heteronormative theology. Father knows best. Those who are not God need to be weak. You can find tons of theological messages about God having the power, about people needing to depend on God. It reinforces this passivity. Now, I hope your minds are also thinking, wait a second, those ideas are a lot older than modernity, and she said heteronormativity didn't come along until the 1800s, right? Okay, so we have ideas of God's omnipotence, for instance, really a long time before we have heterosexuality and homosexuality. I would just suggest that in a cultural frame that's heteronormative, we up the ante of these categories that we already had for God and make them all the more impossible to dislodge. It makes it all the more difficult to do theology otherwise because of heteronormativity.
I'd say the values that get, that are considered like good Christian values will be more on like strength and
good
self-control.
Obedience.
Yeah.
Good. Good Christian values. Strength, self-control, obedience. And we could have a really fun evening trying to think about how these fall out differently in terms of gender. You know, who has to be the more obedient? Who has to be the stronger? There's all sorts of things we could do there. I'm just suggesting to you things you can think about more later. Okay, so I think I need to check this out again now. So we had non-equal or unbalanced. One is over the other. We have need on one side. It's based on opposites. So in a heteronormative theology, we have, if we could draw it somehow, we have a very unbalanced sort of connection. There's need on one side. And this isn't men and women, this is God and creation that ends up being so radically unbalanced. And maybe some of that is really quite true to the biblical witness, but some of it, I think, is a contamination of heteronormativity. So What happens when you do queer theology? That's where we're at now. All right, so now the question on the table is, queer theology equals. And for this, I'd like you to challenge your mind to think God outside of the stuff we just listed. So this is where I was saying at the beginning of the session that I invite you to practice queer theology, to think of it as something you can do on your own. So I'm going to hang this back up so you can see it for a minute. And the new prompt is queer theology equals. And in order to encourage you to be creative, I'd like you to try to get your thoughts down on paper before we share them with each other. I recognize that this is a hard, weird thing I'm asking you to do. So please be patient with yourself if you're feeling like this is a really confusing prompt. But I believe that you have some creative things to share with me. So here you are. All right, queer theology equals, if it is not that heteronormative thing that we've just done, what opens up when we move past the heteronormative? Oh, I gave you no paper, just a Bible for you. There you go, I'm sorry.
You don't get to write
your ideas. You don't get to write your ideas. You just have to read the Bible. So think on that for a moment. Queer theology, or theology outside a heteronormative frame, equals. Okay, I've just torn away heteronormative theology. I've dismantled it. Right, so.
Yay!
So, would that that were so. So, what do we? What's what else could we do? Let's find my orange marker so that I can actually write it down. The one that works. There it is. So, what comes to you? What possibilities are opened up outside of heteronormativity? Give me something to write on my board.
There's less emphasis on the opposites and the dichotomies.
Yes, okay.
I think, like, maybe a relationship that doesn't depend on power dynamics.
Yes. Okay, let me catch up with you here. Less emphasis on opposites and dichotomies. I may have just spelled that wrong. Eh, looks good enough. Less emphasis on opposites and dichotomies. Relationships that don't depend on, and then qualify this for me, what sort of power relationships? They don't depend on what power relationships?
Because, like, in, I guess how I'd say is, like, so heteronormity, like, puts, like, a, you know, like a priest, a male figure between you and God.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Separating, like, maybe
nice.
Taking that element out and having the, like, a relationship with God.
Nice. I like that a lot. Unmediated relationship with God.
Literally rejecting Father Knows Best.
Yeah, literally rejecting Father Knows Best. And I was thinking that the power relation that is gone is this sort of authority over kind of power. It's like a so I don't know how to say that well. Relationships that don't depend on domineering, maybe? Let's just go with that.
Yeah, because I kind of like describe it as like the breaking up of roles, almost.
Yeah. It opens up our roles. It opens up the roles we can play with each other and also with God. So that's exciting, I think. A little scary, perhaps, but exciting. Okay.
Sexuality is good and
yeah. And
life affirming.
Yeah, and sexuality is part of creation.
Yeah. Good. All right. Sex and bodies as good, life affirming, part of creation.
And fluid and active knowledges of God.
Nice. So I can kind of guess where you might be going with fluid knowledges of God. Tell me about active knowledges of God.
Maybe that the ways we do theology or know about God can be changing.
Yes.
So active in terms of maybe those knowledges are adding, there are more of them and they're changing.
Dynamic. Okay, so fluid and...
Maybe our set of knowledges of God is sort of active.
Almost like yogurt culture in a bowl. It's like always growing. It's not yesterday's, isn't the same as tomorrow's, and then you kind
right.
of
yeah.
new air comes in, and maybe not yogurt, but like bread dough yeast or something.
Like
sourdough. Yeah, like the sourdough of theology is always a little different.
Right.
Okay. I think I'm thinking of like yogurt on the side, live and active cultures, you know? Fluid and active knowledges of God.
Yeah, maybe that's where I was coming from.
I might just be thinking about dinner too. This is very good. I am excited with how much you've come up with, and you've been doing queer theology for, when did we start? Is it 4:30? You've been doing this for an hour, and look what you're doing to the relationship with God. This is good. What else is on your paper?
And when you step outside of roles, you can have an expanded understanding of your own gifts.
Nice. So it's not just an expanded view of God, it's an expanded assessment of the self. That's really good. Okay. Yeah, I think your sense of your own gifts, unless you were one of those who considered yourself a representative of God over here in this heteronormative thing, is pretty low. You know, people need to be passive and weak and obedient, and any activity on their part may be sinful. So this is a very different sense of capacity for creation and for humans. So you start to see where I get at the idea that this could be for everyone. This is a far bigger conversation than the already big conversation of how to make a congregation welcoming for people of multiple sexualities. You were about to say something, Shane.
I put those practicing queer theology figure out what they believe, not told what to believe.
Yeah, okay. So you use your own mind.
Kind of like yours. I mean,
uh-huh.
Yeah.
Not passively accepting what to believe. Whoever came up with that Father Knows Best thing, you really captured something. Because so much of this seems to revolve around kind of debunking that idea. Any other
thoughts? And God is beyond gender.
Yeah, good.
Because I think that's a big box.
I do too.
I just look so limiting.
Last thoughts before I put the marker cap on?
Okay.
I'll tell you what, I can take the marker cap back off if someone is there. That is really farther than I expected a group to be able to get in an hour, so I'm really delighted with that. This is part of why I get so excited about queer theology, because I think it really can open up a different way of conceiving our power in the world and the kind of power God has shared with us. When I first started teaching, I almost always taught feminist theology. Now I tend to more often teach queer theology and include feminism in there. I think feminism is, for me, part of how I started thinking otherwise than patriarchy, but queer theology has opened up a lot of doors for me. I brought two examples to share with you because I thought you might like to hear from them. One of them particularly sounds really difficult to hear. I was trying to imagine earlier what it would sound like to just hear this page from this book, because it's a difficult book. So hang on, it's a difficult slice. Okay, this is from Marcella Althaus-Reed, and for me, she's the most dynamic queer theologian to have written thus far. She died way too early of cancer, so we have a limited number of things from her, but the two of the books that I would particularly recommend are Indecent Theology and Queer God. Indecent Theology and Queer God. And there's also many articles out there and books that she helped to edit. So I'm just reading you a small selection from chapter 3, and again, I'm just kind of phrasing it, her, she's very in your face about the way she writes. And I think that's partly because she's trying to knock people out of this heteronormative frame. She suggests that systematic theology, academic theology, has gotten in the habit of being so very heteronormative that it can barely even notice what it's doing. So she writes differently to try to signal that. So this chapter is called Talking Obscenities to Theology, Theology as a Sexual Act. And I'm just jumping you right in the middle. To give you an example of some of the themes that she's working with in another part of her writing, she suggests that Christianity, that Western mainstream Christianity, has become like an S&M sketch, with God as a sadist and humanity as sort of necessarily masochistic. Now, had I said that at the beginning of our hour, you probably would have thought, what in the world? Maybe you wouldn't have. Maybe you would be like, oh, sure, I've thought about that before, too. Possibly, very possibly. But otherwise, it just sounds so far-fetched to just say, well, as she does, Christianity is a master S&M sketch. But it doesn't sound far-fetched once you've done what you all have done in this hour, and you've seen, oh, right, heteronormativity tends toward violent power on one side and a passive obedience on the other. This is not to say that you can't think S&M otherwise. You can, and feminists do. Her point is rather that theology has almost become unconsciously sadistic in its, or sadist in its depictions of God. And so this is a piece that gets you into that a little bit. It's called The Soft Core God. Obviously, it might be simplistic to assume that works of art such as the sacraments may be the only area of fetishization in Christianity. And she's just finished a section on communion as a sort of fetish, so that's what she's referring back to. Theology has also developed an economy of relationships, both internal and external, in which trade patterns can be traced even historically. Women, men, eunuchs, and sodomites fulfilled historically different but mutually dependent functions in the realms of public and domestic life of theological reflections. This can be identified as part of a soft core theology, a gentle theological construction where sexual oppression is explicit, but kept to what are understood as natural tolerable limits. As in soft core pornographic films, there are frontiers to be observed. In softcore theology, God needs to be boundary marked by, say, sodomites to express the value that reproduction gives to human relationships and defining God's values too. Without the construction of the sodomite, you can imagine a sort of scare quote around sodomite every time she's using the term, the heterosexual godly values could not be exalted enough in theology. God's high seminal message, and I'm sure she's meaning to play on the word semen there, God's high seminal message would never be shown to the world with such ejaculatory strength if God had competitors. Sodomites are the non-competitors who exalt God's reproductive message to the world. These theological patterns are constitutive of what we can call a soft core pornographic theology. Women and sexual dissidents in general are merely depicted for the consumption of the constructed male heterosexual reader. Their images may be fixed in situations of pain and sexual torture, but these are acceptable in the history of Christianity. For instance, we may see this as a second-rate porno film where Eve gives birth in pain forever, Tamar is raped interminably by her brother, Jesus hangs naked from a cross, hands nailed, blood coming from a crown of thorns on his head, Mary says yes to the first angel in her life who appears in her room. What a queer theology this is in the old-fashioned sense of queer. Indecent theology forces a soft-core porno theology, namely systematic theology, to assume its real hardcore nature and to come out with the crudeness of its sexual constructions. Sadly, we are so used to soft-core theology that we're willing to project these films of Eve and Tamar and the Virgin Mary to children in Sunday school. However, in the strange ways of the world and in the present state of theology today, indecenting, that is, denouncing the real hardcore sexual nature of systematic theology,
while announcing gender and sexual deconstructions, which could carry precious meaning to our lives in relation to the sacred and the political implications of theology as idolatry, is considered scandalous and immoral. That last sentence is so complicated, I'm going to read it again. What she's trying to suggest here is that Christian theology has become so used to its sexual violence and also to its, not just sexual violence, but a kind of patriarchal violence, right down to a glorification of Jesus's violent death, that these ideas are just so normal. So that you do have Sunday school rooms with rather bloody crucifix images. And you do hear stories talked about as though some of these Bible stories are just Bible stories. She says, Indecent Theology, that's the name of her book, forces theology to look at how very, in our terms today, heteronormative it's all become and how very violent it is. But it's this kind of work that you all did here on this board where we get Rejecting Father Knows Best and Relations That Don't Depend on Domineering Power Relations, that gets called scandalous and immoral. So queer theology, this gets called the weird thing to do, not listening to authority. Whereas reifying again and again all that other stuff is seen as okay. So that's what she's saying in this last sentence, so I'll read it once more again. In the strange way of the world and in the present state of theology today, indecenting and denouncing the real hardcore sexual nature of systematic theology while announcing gender and sexual deconstructions which could carry precious meaning to our lives and announcing the political implications of theology as ideology, that's considered scandalous and immoral. So thus her book is called Indecent Theology. So she's a really prophetic in the sense of the biblical prophets calling for justice. She's a very prophetic writer. And then I have a piece which is easier to share with others who wouldn't have maybe been part of a conversation like ours. So it's one I use more often if I don't have time to talk a group through heteronormativity. And this is a piece called God is a Many-Gendered Thing, An Apophatic Journey to Pastoral Diversity. The author is B.K. Hipsher. But this is in a new volume, which I'd recommend to you, called Transformations, TRANS/formations, Transformations. And that's an edited volume full of different theologians and other writers thinking about queer theology, but also, in some cases, specifically trans theology. So it's a very new book. And one piece of it is this. Okay, so this author does what's called apophatic theology. When you do apophatic theology, you say what something isn't instead of trying to say what God is, so or what a thing is. So instead of saying God is loving, you would say all the nots of God. And so what this person does is go through God is not male. Well, God is also not female. This gets to your God beyond gender. And then God can't even be summarized with some of the images or metaphors of gay and lesbian identity. Okay, so what about transgender? And then this author says, no, even transgender wouldn't quite do it. And so having done all that, then we get to this piece in this part of the article that I've marked off for you. We see this kind of drama playing out in various Christian denominations by excluding gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people from membership in the worst cases. These people are simply pushed out of their faith communities when they come out as something other than binary gender construct, heterosexual identified persons. In some cases, homosexual couples are tolerated if they conform to the binary construct in other ways of dress, action, etc. For instance, if a gay male couple dresses appropriately as men, perform male gender construction, and form a nuclear family unit complete with marriage bonds and promises of monogamy, they may attain a level of acceptance, having tapped into so many intersections of the dominant cultural heteronormative identity.
Another acceptable manifestation might be a lesbian couple where neither of the women dress too masculinely or too femininely. Perhaps they adopt or give birth to one or more children and again marry and perform the heteronormative couple signifiers, such as monogamy. Where the rubber meets the road is when a gay man transitions to female gender identity, with or without surgery, and doesn't pass well. For example, when a male-to-female transsexual continues to have a deep voice, masculine movements or attitudes, yet identifies and dresses as a woman. Or when one partner in a nice lesbian couple begins to take testosterone, has chest reconstruction surgery to remove breasts, and proceeds to dress, act, and live as a man. At this point, most Christian denominations freeze. If they tolerate the person at all, there's no community outreach, no sense of inclusion, no image of God in the context of the church community with which this particular incarnation of the Christic presence can identify. More overt rejection of a person like this can include emotional, spiritual, and physical violence visited on the transsexual person in the name of keeping the ranks of the faithful clean and holy. It is precisely because a transgender image of God is so unsettling to most people that we're compelled to argue for it. So this is the point in the article where the person is just trying on for size whether just transgender would do for God. That Hipscher will soon work away from that here in just a minute. If God cannot be male only, female only, male and female complementary composite, then what is the apophatic conclusion? I believe we're compelled to image God in the ever-changing, shifting, diverse, and multiple transgender realities that human beings embody. To encapsulate God in any single gender identity or sexual expression limits the possibilities of God's manifestations in humanity. Furthermore, a human embodiment that is outside these limited images of God would be open to attack and violence in the name of forcing conformity to the natural ways of God. But is an image of a transgender God still too limiting, too small, to hold the God of the universe? The simple answer is yes. And then the author says, what we need is a trans God. And the author, Hipscher, stops writing in the previous paragraph. The author, Hipscher, here was just writing transgender God, just those two words. But now, every time else that this appears in the paragraph, it's trans slash God, like that. So this is a new thing that the author's trying to coin here. We need a trans God, all right, one that transgresses all our ideas about who and what God is and can be, one that transports us to new possibilities for how God can incarnate in the multiplicity of human embodiments, one that transfigures our mental images from limitations, one that transforms our ideas about our fellow humans and ourselves, one that transcends all we know or think we know about God and about humanity as the image of God. So this is how this author gets around to saying, not a male God, not a female God, not a gay God or a lesbian God or a transgender God, but something like an always transitioning God image, which is really quite close, I think, to where Lisa ended up, with a fluid and active knowledge of God. An idea of God that can never quite be pinned down because God's incarnational and our bodies are always alive and changing and shifting. So that piece is, I think, a way to gently nudge folks who haven't thought about these issues very much, to nudge them toward thinking about how a more dynamic image of God could be really inviting for them. And then Marcella Althaus-Reed, who I read to you first, offers a much more scathing critique of what heteronormativity has done to Christianity. Okay. Having read those two pieces, is there anything that really jumped out at you that you would like to ask about or comment on? You don't have to. I just want to make space for that.
I mean, I like the second one you read. I think that the topic, like, they explain where, like, if you have enough heteronormity, like, they're okay with it to some degree.
Right.
And even that fact, like, we don't even need to go into this, but, like intersectionality, like, that's even just, like, a white construct of heteronormativity.
What heteronormativity looks like.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I think that's like an interesting like intro to this like way to explain this.
Yes, thank you. in many ways, that little description of how congregations are okay with a certain kind of gayness, a certain kind of white middle class gayness or lesbianness, helps to show how heteronormativity has power over gay and lesbian constructions too. So that it's not just like straight, quote unquote, straight couples end up having tried to act in certain ways, but that gay and lesbian couples start being forced to replicate those ways in order to find acceptance. It's part of also the way to look at the inadequacies of marital legality as enough somehow. That was a contorted sentence. What I'm saying is thinking about heteronormativity can also help you to see how just making gay marriage legal isn't enough. Like to make gay marriage legal is huge. So for a minute, you know, or for several years even, this is a thing to really celebrate. At the same time, what it's done is it's taking a heteronormative institution and stuck more people in it, rather than saying, under what other frameworks can we love, have families, share life? It's budging more people into already a heteronormative social institution.
And excluding.
Yeah. At the same time. Right. Exactly. Thank you. There, if that particular topic is something interesting to some of you, the article that you can find on the internet called Marriage Will Never Set Us Free is an interesting thinking piece about that. Marriage will never set us free. Okay, I was glad to get that reaction to this piece. What do you, any other reactions? I was really trying today to think, what would they want to hear? What would a group of people coming to Holden Village want to hear from queer theology? So I chose these two. Also, if you're curious what else is out there, or if I could direct you to other kinds of sources, you could ask that if you'd like. Anything on your on the tip of your tongue?
Just thinking years, I mean, quite a while ago, but this really became extremely heated, difficult discussion when we were talking about kind of what you're talking about. So you put everyone in these boxes, so now monogamy. And can you be Christian and not be monogamous?
Right.
And some people thought we couldn't even talk about it.
Yeah.
Because
exactly.
It was just so absolutely...
not allowed.
Yeah.
Conversation.
Yeah. It's kind of what you were saying about, well, now we have gay marriage, so gay marriage is going to look like two people in a house.
It's going to look like monogamy all over again.
Well, also being very middle class.
Right.
And,
yeah. And stable in a sort of long-term way.
Yeah.
And geared toward a kind of economic structure.
Exactly.
The whole
towards
thing.
An economic structure.
Yeah.
Too.
The whole thing. Right.
But so it's really... that's really pushing the envelope, I think, when you go beyond just...
yeah, it is. It is really pushing the envelope.
Yeah, so good.
I think a good thought experiment that I've really gotten from feminist theory and queer theory rather than my theological circles would be, whenever you're thinking about these systems, ask yourself, who benefits?
Right.
So, you know, who benefits from these systems of economic household,
mm-hmm.
discrete economic households and so forth? I don't pretend to have the answer. I just think it's a good thing to ask who benefits, whose bodies benefit, and so forth. There's still so much envelope pushing to be done, I think. While I'm giving you a piece of paper, do you have any other thoughts or questions? I invite you to approach me. You know, I'm going to be here at Holden for a while yet, so if you want to talk about sources or anything, just
so cool.
You're welcome to come up and ask. So what I'd like to now do, just with our few minutes that are left, is challenge you to make another piece of paper for yourself. So you might save the first one that you made. The first one was where you tried to figure out what queer theology would equal. You could stick that in your pocket and go on a winter walk and try to do some more queer theology. Like, you could just pick a doctrine. You know, you could say to yourself, how would queer theology reshape the way I think about Christ? How would queer theology, pick another doctrine, shape the way I think about forgiveness, sin, justification, any big kind of power words that have had good or bad meanings for you. Try on for size what queer theology could do for that. That's a exercise I invite you to. Now on the second piece of paper, I invite you to write down how you would say to someone who didn't come to this session what queer theology could offer. So if they were to, this can kind of remind you later what queer theology can offer. So if they were to say, oh, you went to a queer theology thing while you were up at Holden last, why should I care about that? What does queer theology do? Try to answer or finish the sentence on your page. Queer theology offers. Just try to finish that sentence for your own memory. Queer theology offers. So I mostly wanted you to do that for yourself so that you could kind of summarize some things you may have picked up this afternoon. But I'm also a little curious if a couple of you would volunteer what you wrote down. I think if I had to just do this on the fly, if somebody said on the bus on the way back down the mountain, oh, I didn't go to your session, what's that about anyway? I might say quickly, well, queer theology offers a way to open up our ideas about God and about human life. And then they can just be curious. And I'll tell them the rest of their time, because it's too much for the bus ride. So tell maybe just two or three others of you willing to share how you'd summarize what queer theology can offer.
I think what you said at the beginning about a lot of people thinking through the view of, like, how can we add people to our group when instead, like, hey, if we go out, there's so much we can benefit from.
Right.
And be open.
Awesome. Yeah. It takes apart that idea of inclusion. It said it's more of an expansion. That's what I would hope. Okay, two other people, maybe?
I just said that it was a way to reframe theology and to look at it outside of human-created social structures and power dynamics.
Nice. Yes.
Good. Thank you.
Encourages questions.
Yeah, good. Did she kind of say what you said?
Pretty much the same as you, but
okay.
You broke it down a little better. I just said beyond heteronormativity. But I couldn't decide if maybe it was better to use some
other
simpler
words.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
Depend cool. who I was talking to. I guess.
Yeah, yes, it would. It would for me.
Some
too.
People would. That would be a great.
Yeah.
Like, oh,
right.
Christians do that? Sweet.
Yeah, exactly. Good. Well, for me, a lot of it does come back to trying to help people understand that there's more in queer theology than just a way to welcome gay and lesbian persons into the church. As though that's just kind of a just. That's not a just. That's huge. I mean, if the churches were places where people who identify as gay and lesbian, even just gay and lesbian, could thrive, then the churches would be so different. So that I shouldn't minimize that, but it doesn't even begin to get at how much we could reframe in theology if we got outside of these heteronormative things. I think I often think that this is a way that queer theology can line up with some other forms of liberation theology, for instance, as well. Because, for instance, if you came on Monday, I read a little bit of James Cone, a little piece of James Cone from his Black Theology and Black Power from 1969. And I think one way that, from a kind of white supremacist mindset, somebody could misframe what's happening in that theology is they think, oh, well, there's theology for black people. That's such a misread. What was really going on in his Black Theology and Black Power was a remaking of the whole theological enterprise. Like, he's not just saying this is how some people should do theology. He's saying, in America today, theology has to start from this other place. I think you can do something very similar with queer theology. You can say, no, this isn't just for certain groups, for certain concerns. This is about the core of how we do theology, taking apart heteronormativity, taking apart white supremacy, taking apart patriarchy, for instance.